Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDilling and I am very lucky to be here today with the amazing Candace Fox.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Candace, can you tell us a bit about your new book, Crimson Lake?
So Crimson Lake is the story of a man named Ted Concaffey. He is accused of a horrific sexual assault on a young girl, and he's not acquitted of the crime. He's just sort of, the charges are dropped, so Ted flees to the far north Queensland, where he meets another investigator, Amanda Farrell, who fully admits to stabbing her friend to death when she was 17 years old. So you have two investigators, both accused of terrible crimes. One of them is guilty, and the crime that they're investigating together is a missing local author in Crimson Lake in the far north. So the steamy sort of wetlands, the menacing, sinister environment, that's kind of what I was going for. Yeah, crocodiles, yeah.
Well, I absolutely love this book. From the moment I started reading, I could not put it down. Is no longer a surprise for me now when I get one of your books. I just expect that. So that's a high benchmark for you.
Yeah, no pressure.
And I remember when you came in last year to talk to us about Never Never, you did like briefly give us a synopsis of this book, and ever since then I've been like raring to read. Where did you first get the first spark for this idea? Because it's such a good setup for a story.
Yeah.
And when I tell people like about this book and just give them the briefest outline of what it's about, everyone's immediately interested.
Oh, awesome. Like, that's great.
I just wondered, was it inspired at all by like a real case or?
I was very interested in the time at all of the accusations that were going around about people like Robert Hughes and Rolf Harris and that sort of thing. Bill Cosby. I was very interested in everyone's reactions when the accusations first came out, because I found people saying that, I knew it was true all along, he's that type of guy, and obviously it's true because people like normal people don't get accused of that sort of thing. And yeah. I was just thinking, what if it's not true? People seem so certain, and I thought, if you were ever accused of being a sex offender, a child sex offender in particular, you just would never get rid of that stain. Yeah. You would never overcome that. And I was looking at these guys and thinking, it's over. It's over for you. Because
no matter what happens now, even if you're proved innocent in court, you will never...
You've always got that accusation on you. So I was interested in that, and little sparks of ideas will come from all sorts of different places. Like Amanda, in the book, I was trying to channel Amanda Knox. I don't know if you know a lot about Foxy Knoxy, as the press called her. She was accused of, with her boyfriend, of murdering her flatmate in Perugia in Italy, and the initial suspicion about Amanda was simply because she was so odd, she was in the police station doing yoga poses and pulling funny faces at her boyfriend and laughing and not sort of looking like she was very aggrieved about her friend's murder. And so the Italian police just kind of went, it's her, obviously.
Because she's so weird,
yeah. And so I wanted to play around with that. And that's initially why I called Amanda, because I was trying to focus myself on Amanda Knox. I pulled all these strings together to create this novel, yeah.
There's like, speaking of all the strings, you've got the backstories of Ted and Amanda unfolding at the same time as you've got this central mystery, which is about the disappearance of a kind of, I don't know, I was like thinking of him as kind of like a male Stephanie Meyer type figure. A super famous author of like popular supernatural YA fiction. Mm. And so all of that's going on, and you've got Ted's point of view, but you've also got letters from one of the authors, super fans.
Like, yeah, super fan, yeah.
Yeah, really disturbing. And then, you know, occasionally, like, transcripts of interviews and court trials and stuff. I just want to know, like, what's your process there? Like, do you always... It seems like so much to bring together. Like,
yeah, it's funny. I don't like to say that I do it instinctively because it sounds like I'm trying to be... Oh, I'm a genius and I just use my instinct, you know. But I think I do have a good handle on when to leave a particular scene so that people, you know, people don't want you to leave. It's not finished yet. So, for example, with that interview with Amanda, the interrogation, it's in the novel as a transcript. It's not a scene. And I just thought it would be more effective that way. If it was an artifact, it would look more real. And then you only get sort of couple of minutes of that interview. It's just a snippet and it sort of reveals things about Amanda's character, but not really. And then you leave before you get any satisfaction. And I've done that with my novels before. In the Bennett Archer series, I would have a present day storyline and a past storyline in italics. And I found that if you leave at a moment that's really critical and you know, like people are right on the edge of understanding something, and then you leave, they're furious to get back to that moment again. So they read the next bit really quickly, and then if that next bit ends in a way that has a hook as well, people fly through the novel in 24 hours.
That's a pretty accurate description of my experience.
That's what I was trying to do. Yeah, it's I hate to end a scene and you sort of feel like, and then everything was fine, you know, because that's when a reader
that's
will put
down
the
book,
down. Yeah, and go, oh, I got to go pick the kids up from school. And it's great when I hear these stories. It just sold into, Crimson Lake just sold into the UK, I mean, the US in a big way. It is in the UK as well, but I was talking to my US publishers and she said, we had people missing subway stops, not picking up their kids, you know, letting their dinner go cold, like all these stories of people across the office who were reading Crimson Lake and just getting sucked in and not being able to come back out again.
Yeah, so, it's like that. And it's if, even if, this wasn't the case for me, but even if you weren't interested in one thing that was happening, you've got multiple things going on. Like I read the whole thing desperate for Ted to be vindicated, desperate to find out what on earth had happened that night with Amanda, and desperate to know who is this super fan and what has happened
to Ted
like
to Jake
Scully. I like, you know, and so every time there was a switch, it's like, yes, you're back to this part. And it was just like you do fly through it. You just can't help it down. And you desperately want more when it ends. And like, speaking of all the different POVs and stuff, you have, I don't know if this is a mild spoiler, but I won't name the character, but you have a point of view switch right at the end. Will we have more of that point of view?
Oh,
first of all, will there be more books about these characters?
Yes. So Crimson Lake was supposed to be just a standalone. I was just having a break from the Bennett Archer series and then I was going to go back to the Bennett Archer series. But it's been so well received internationally that all the publishers kind of got together and were like, we need another one of these. So, the second book, I'm writing the second book now, and I'm trying to do the same sort of thing. There are multiple crimes and there is a diary all the way through. So, you know, you have those super fan letters. There's someone's therapy journal all the way through, and that's how you access that other character, that other point of view. But... in this case, in the second novel, I've got Ted and Amanda separated for some of it. So in order to have some Amanda and then some Ted, there's different perspectives in that sense as well. So, yeah, it'll be the same, but, you know, like all the same or better, but, you know, I'm trying new things as well. Yeah, it's exciting.
I know that it's a long way away, but I'm already looking forward to it.
Oh, good.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, there's this really interesting idea that came up when Ted was talking about being in prison. And him and Amanda had very different experiences of being in prison.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something that he said about how you can't see evil in people. It's not like you can look at people and there's something there that makes them obviously evil.
Mm-hmm.
And like that just really stuck with me. It,
yeah.
This is a weird segue, but I don't know if you know the song Westfall by Okkervil River.
No.
Well, the refrain of that is evil. It's about a murder.
Okay.
It's about some kids who murder other kids, and
ooh,
the refrain is evil don't look like anything.
Yeah, right, right,
like,
right, right.
Yeah, that's like a terrifying thought because it really,
it's terrifying.
It does mean that, you know, you could.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's very scary for me. It's a theme that I've been exploring for a little while now, that you can't see badness, or I suppose that you don't even really know anyone. It started very personally for me. I had a partner who I was with for 7 years cheat on me, and I thought for those 7 years that I knew this person, you know what I mean? Like I knew every intimate molecule of his being, you know, like I knew the way he breathed and I knew his history and I knew, you know, like
yeah.
I thought I knew this person. And then you turn around one day and you go, whoa, like I don't know you at all.
Yeah.
And I think that shock and horror really unsettled me as a person, and it made me look at not only relationships later on in my life, but my friends and
yeah.
my family, and it made me look at all sorts of people differently. And I'm always a little bit extra mortified when I think that somebody is normal, and or you know, I think that I've got my head around someone and then I don't,
they
you know,
some
yeah.
yeah,
like we were just talking earlier about someone who I've dealt with on a professional level for a few years, who has suddenly out of nowhere started acting very strange. And I think it's because of the swift uptake in my success. They're
yeah.
suddenly treating me different. And I sort of think, I thought I knew you, and
but
I
you
don't. And
yeah.
you were creeping me out, you know.
I found that a really interesting
yeah,
concept.
It's scary. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Because your husband, like, I've watched documentaries where the husband is a serial killer and the wife doesn't know. And she's sleeping next to him every night, and
which Ted's wife sort of goes through, even though
yeah.
in this instance he's innocent. The world views her as, did you know? Like, how could
yeah.
you have been married
how
to him
could you
for
not
all
know?
This time?
Yeah.
Ted was such a fascinating character.
You like him?
yeah, he's great.
I like him
and
too.
I love how, like, you know, he just had so many great moments, and like at one point, and to talk about media as well, I want to briefly talk
sure.
about media in the book and how, like, it sort of portrays people like this. and there's a character in the book called Fabiana.
Yeah.
And he's talking to her at one point, and she's saying, oh, you know, you're just such a nice guy. Like, I came here looking for a monster, and you're this gentle, nice man. And, you know, attractive and stuff. And and he was like, I can't remember the exact quote, but I think
yeah.
along the lines of, if I was a cross-eyed hunchback, you should still...
Yes.
I would still want you
yeah.
to look at the facts of my case. And not,
yeah.
it shouldn't be about, I'm a gentleman. It should be about, am I innocent? Or am
well,
I guilty?
See, I looked into the Daniel Morcombe abduction quite intimately. I was very... you know, captured by that crime. It's very hard to disturb me at all, really, but I was deeply disturbed by that. And I remember the first time I saw Brett Peter Cowan's picture in the paper, I looked at him and I thought, but he's so handsome, you know? And I thought, because he's not a bad looking dude.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what does that mean? Does it mean that you can't be a pedophile and a murderer
if
you're
handsome?
Yeah, and I was just shocked by it, I suppose. And you know, you expect evil people to look evil, or at least to act evil, you know. And so when you find a really nice one, that's why Ted Bundy. I talk about Ted Bundy a lot because he's my favorite serial killer. If you can have a favorite serial killer, you know, I know that's a bit weird. Everyone was extra shocked by Ted Bundy because he was so handsome and clever and charismatic. Anne Rule was friends with him, and she wrote the book about it. And she used to sit next to Ted at the suicide hotline, you know. And she called the book "The Stranger Beside Me," because she sort of went through this realization that this man, who was very handsome and very nice, who she'd been friends with for decades, who she had sat next to, literally saving people's lives on the phone with, was a serial killer. Mm-hmm. One of the most prolific serial killers in American history. And she just did not know at all. And doesn't that just rock your world, you know? And so when people say things like, oh, Rolf Harris, I knew he was a pedophile, you know, because you can tell or you can see them, you kind of, I kind of felt like...
come up that, yeah, like, I saw him one time do this. Or...
yeah, you think you can't see it because it's just not, you can't see it. It doesn't look like anything, you know, like evil. It just,
So there's one other thing I wanted to, another part, I keep bringing up like quotes from the book, but there's one part where Amanda, who I've been talking all about Ted and how great he is, but Amanda is also so amazing eccentric and interesting. But she's talking one time about books, and she says like that they're like your guts, and you scoop your guts out and give them to someone. This is in the context of someone who, an aspiring author in the novel, who keeps getting rejected. Mm. And I just thought, is that what it's like for you when you write? Like you're scooping up your guts and handing them to people, and then
It is. It's, I mean, Crimson Lake is my sixth published work. And I am still so vulnerable when I put a manuscript in to my agent and my publisher. They're the two ladies who see it, or the two people who see my work first in the world. And it's like I've told them what I'm going to write about. They've seen pieces of it sometimes. I've got all this success already. I've got awards and things. You would think that I feel a little bit safe, but I don't. Every time I serve the manuscript up, I'm like, oh my god, they're gonna hate it, you know.
Gutless and hollow.
Leaving me gutless and hollow. And then also, I mean, in that situation, Amanda is talking about someone she was in jail with who was an aspiring author and kept getting rejected and then murdered her publisher. The publisher she'd been in contact with all this time. And I remember being an aspiring author and being so angry and frustrated that I couldn't get published. You know, I had over 200 rejection letters before Hades was published. And I was so angry, and it felt really personal.
Yeah.
Even though I just get these automated, you know, thank you for submitting this
standard
to this
response.
Standard response, I would see other books that got published and I'd be like, that is garbage, like, what, why did that get published
and not
my work? And it felt like publishing, you know, there was this great party inside this building and I was in the queue outside and I could see through the windows like how amazing the party was inside and they just wouldn't let me in, and I'd get to the door and they'd be like, nope, and then I go to the back of the queue and I get to the door and I'm like, nope, and people right next to me or right in front of me would get in and I'd try to do exactly what they did and I couldn't get in. And after a while you just go, it's me, they're doing it to me, you know, and you get angry. And so I blew that out of proportion, obviously, in the novel.
Because murder.
Because, yeah, because I would not go around and murder my publisher. It was that frustration and anger that I was just trying to tap into.
That is also present in the Superfan letters. That was great. I loved reading, as someone who sort of works in the book industry, as a bookseller, I kind of love that this book had an element of that, like there was about a missing author and that you went into like the writing process during it. Like I got a real kick out of that aspect.
It's scary because, like, again, I've blown it out of proportion. Like, I don't get super fan letters like that, or I would.
I was going to ask you. Yeah. Aside from me, what other crazy fans do you have?
Oh my god! No, I would be calling the police like immediately. But I think the thing that about being an author, which is really weird, is that Like me, for example, if you read all of my novels, you've spent like 50 hours inside my mind or more, inside my personal fantasy and with people that I've created. And then you might listen to a few interviews of me and you might read about me in a paper or whatever. But slowly, slowly, you gather all of these facts and things about me. And then you meet me at a library or something. And you feel like you know me, but I don't know you from a bar of soap. I don't even know what your name is. So people come up sometimes and they say all this stuff about me and they know all this stuff about me. And I'm like, oh, God, I don't know you at all. Like, it's confronting.
It's weird,
and
yeah.
Or they write to me in a very intimate way, the way you would write to somebody that you've known for years. And I'm like, why is this person telling me these things? You know, they're three lines in and they're telling me deeply, deeply personal, traumatic stuff. And
I'm like, feel like they know
they
you.
Feel like they know me, but I don't know them. And it's a weird phenomenon. And sometimes,
yeah.
Like during the day, it's fine. But sometimes late at night, I lie there and I think, oh, God.
You
know, this
going
is
to
a little bit
up
scary.
By a crocodile.
Yeah. Please don't feed me to a crocodile. Oh, I had a nightmare about crocodiles like 3 nights ago. I was talking about them and how scary they are. And I was trying to jump over these rocks and there were these crocodiles and like it was scary. In the dream, yeah.
That's what happens when you write books about people getting eaten by crocodiles.
I actually managed to scare myself. It's weird, yeah.
So you've now got 3 series running. We've got the Eden and Frank one.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Harry Blue.
Harry, yeah, Never Never, yeah.
And now we've got Crimson Lake. So I'm equally obsessed with all of these, so I don't mind what the answer to this question is, but which is coming next out? Like,
So literally the next thing out in Australia will be the second full novel in the Harriet Blue series.
Cool.
That's Last Chance. So I think that's due out in about August. And then December or January, you'll get Crimson Lake 2. When it comes to the Bennett Archer series, I don't know if I'll be able to go back to that. It's not that I'm opposed to going back to that, but it depends on, you know, because with the Crimson Lake series, I will have scooped up a whole bunch of new fans. And so if I write a book 4 of Bennett Archer, they're all going to go, oh, well, you know, I have to go back now to Hades and read 3 before I get this new one. So,
yeah
in terms of, you know, what the publisher's schedule is for me, it may not be another Bennett Archer, but it may be that we drive those sales up. But this early in my career, I just have to do what they tell me to do. So they've told me
I'm pretty much cool whatever comes next.
Yeah,
I'm like,
cool.
I will pick up
any
one of those stories where we left it quite happily.
I think that some artists would be mortified by that, being told what to write or anything like that. It's not like they're sitting over my shoulder, you know, dictating what I write, but they sort of suggest heavily.
Yeah,
and I kind of go, all right, whatever, you know. Like, I don't mind. So yeah.
Well, I will look forward to August.
Yeah.
For more Harry.
You love Harry.
Yeah, I do. But I also, I mean, any of it really. Like, I have not read a book of yours that I haven't just totally loved. Not to go all super fan on you, but actually, yes. And Hannah, thank you so much for coming in today to talk to us.
Yeah. It's always great. Yeah.
Hope you come back soon.
Yeah.
And podcast listeners, you can get any of Candace Fox's books, including her latest Crimson Lake, at Booktopia.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.